Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding areas. And our show brings the culture to horticulture. So and we have...
Go ahead, Alice.
We have a shout out today.
Oh, yes. I wanted to do a shout out to Carolyn Hooks, who is one of our biggest fans. She totally made our day.
Our weekend.
And our weekend on Sunday when she said that we were her heroes.
And her favorite gardening podcast.
Yeah. So, Carolyn. Yeah.
Because it really is a competition.
Damn straight.
Winning.
So Carolyn gardens in Pittsburgh at the Phipps Conservatory, which is a wonderful public garden to visit. So anyway, thank you, Carolyn, for sharing your love of We Dig Plants with us.
Congrats, guys. I'm just so tired of all the winning.
Winning. Winner. It's all about winning. Okay. So as you all know, for this year, we're traveling all over the United States, and we're looking at gardening within each zone. So we're talking to gardeners and farmers, extension agents, botanists, designers, writers, and growers to reflect new, unique, and relevant ideas in each zone. And we're sharing their stories with you each month and periodically on our blog, and creating, hopefully, a little zone envy in the process, so that people will start traveling to different gardens and looking at the landscape as a cultural additive.
Yeah, and realizing that you can garden amazingly anywhere, no matter what your limitations. And that's why we highlight these climactic zones to talk about the challenges and how people overcame them.
So Carmen and I are really out in the gardens now. It's super warm here in the Northeast.
No, it's getting there.
Well, yeah, we've had so much rain that my boots are sometimes floating away.
Yeah, I read that it was the wettest April on record since 1895.
Well, I can attest to that.
Yeah.
And we're not sure sometimes where we are because of these climatic changes. Are we in New York City? So this got us thinking about the crazy relationships and the codependency of humidity and heat. Welcome to Zone 9, today's show, where the minimum temperatures are 20 to 30 degrees on average. So today it's going to be really fun. We are first speaking with Anne McDonald from New Orleans, and then for the second half of the show, Troy Bancord from Palm Springs. Both New Orleans and Palm Springs are in Zone 9. And what struck us most is that they differ so vastly in humidity levels, but both offer the same heat temperatures. So let's get started with New Orleans and Anne McDonald. First, I'd also like to thank the City of New Orleans and their Director of Communications at the Mayor's Office, Curtis Elmore, for introducing us to Anne as the representative and point person for today's discussion of horticulture in New Orleans.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about Anne. Since July of 2001, Anne McDonald has served as the director of the Department of Parks and Parkways for the City of New Orleans. The city's Department of Parks and Parkways manages, maintains, develops, beautifies, and preserves over 2,000 acres of New Orleans' public green space, which includes over 200 parks and squares, including Jackson Square, Armstrong Park, Congo Square, and Lafayette Square. Additionally, Parks and Parkways oversees the city's neutral grounds and the Joseph M. Bartholomew Municipal Golf Course and over 450,000 trees.
Welcome, Anne.
Yes, thank you. How are you all today? And thanks for having me.
Oh, well, thank you for joining us. And I really am so appreciative of the mayor's office. It was wonderful when I reached out. They responded right away, and we're delighted to have you join us.
Well, happy to talk about our beautiful landscape and urban canopy here in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we are getting hot down here. We're, you know, we don't have much of a spring. We kind of go from fall to summer in a lot of aspects.
Yeah. So tell us about the weather in your city, because if you haven't traveled to New Orleans, there's just one word you need to know, which is humidity.
Yes, I would recommend traveling to New Orleans between October and May. Once we get into June, July, and August, while it is a beautiful city, unless you can deal with some days of 90 and 100% humidity, it for those who are not used to it, it takes a little bit out of them. But it also, that humidity makes our plants very happy.
Right. Oh, I was there on Bastille Day once, Anne.
It's literally you walk out the front door and you're sweating.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So have to be prepared to glow throughout the day.
It didn't matter. It's so beautiful. The whole city's a garden. That's how I see it. The entire city's a garden.
Right.
You know?
Yes. We live in a perfect environment for vegetation. I think about doing the summer months when we have those 2,000 acres of grass to cut, and there are people that have come from other cities or colleagues that work in other cities will call me about our grass cutting or our different programs for grass maintenance, and they'll talk about, well, we cut like on a 3 to 4 week or 5 week cycle. Not here. Everything grows here.
Right. Right. Well, the elevation is also, you are at sea level, right?
No, we are in a bowl.
You're in a bowl.
New Orleans is literally a bowl. Now, there are some areas around the city that are higher, like close to the river.
Uh-huh.
Is more of the ridge of the bowl. But we are below sea level.
Ah.
The inner part of the city, and that's what, you know, so much happened after Katrina.
Yes.
The lake literally drained where the levees failures were. It wasn't that we got a lot of rainwater and it just didn't drain enough. With the levee breaches, the lake literally drained into the city, and that's what took us so long to get that water out because it was down in the bowl.
Right. Wow. So let's talk about that. How did that affect your vegetation?
Well, obviously, the areas that were heavily flooded, it took us many, many years to recover. You know, turf, after a few summers, started to, you know, Bermuda started to come back, and through a program that we have, we've been able to really create and have a good turf establishment. But what really suffered, the live oak survived well, the cypress trees were fine. It was the magnolia trees.
Mm.
And magnolias, that brackish salt water that drained into the city, and magnolias already have a very sensitive root system.
Right.
We had corridors where we had beautiful standing trees that were dead.
Right.
The wind did not do the damage to the magnolias. It was the flood water. But we removed them, and we're not going to not plant magnolia trees in the city. You know,
of course.
We are a southern city. The magnolia tree is one of our state trees. So we're praying that the, you know, Army Corps of Engineers has done what they needed to do to repair, and we continue to plant and have a, you know, an interesting canopy of various trees around the city.
So tell us, what grows the best where you are, and what do you most battle with?
Well, we've done some things. Well, crepe myrtles grow very well.
Uh-huh.
Live oaks, cypress trees, which are native to our city, do very well. Live oaks, I would think, are one of the best. They're the sturdiest. They have handled hundreds of years. We have live oaks in the city that are several hundred years old, mm-hmm. and they are still standing and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
We even have put in willow oaks. Now, we had a drought a few summers ago during the summer months, and the Willow Oaks kind of struggled, but we just stayed on them, made sure that we fertilized them appropriately and kept them watered, and now they seem to be good and established and, you know, will be a good tree moving forward. But our summers are so hot, so when everybody is having Earth Day in April, New Orleans has Earth Day in probably January, and sometimes we'll do it in November, because our tree planting season is not the same as, you know, other cities, because right. we're not going to install a tree. We want to make sure the tree gets in the ground long before we start to battle the heat of summer.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
We have holly trees do very well here.
Okay.
And some of those are natives. We've even put in red maples in certain areas. It's not something we're going to plant a large variety of, and not on, we'll put them more in parks in a protected area.
Uh-huh.
But we try to, in spite of the challenged conditions, we want to have an interesting canopy. So we are very thoughtful as to the types of trees we plant and where we plant them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, whenever I think of the South, I always think of, you know, this kind of jungle-like environment, especially deep South, where this humidity and this heat is. Do you all have problems with invasive plants? And tell us.
Oh, God, cat's claw. And when you say jungle-like, it yeah. makes me think of a space we have. It's one of our more natural parks in Algiers called Brechtel Park. There are some parts of the park, it's like a jungle. In fact, there was a movie that was filmed in the park because in the natural area, it was a jungle. So, yes, during the summer, we just, you know, between the cat's claw, and we're very worried about what is happening because they're basically suffocating some of the canopies
right.
trees
right.
in that natural area. But we've got a really good volunteer group of people in New Orleans, NOLA Tree Project, SOUL, which is sustaining our urban landscape, where folks, I think since Katrina, while it was dealt a heavy blow to the city, it made our residents really appreciate our public green spaces and our trees.
Yeah.
Where we work together to kind of keep those things at bay. But I love the description because it is. And even in our personal yards, if you don't stay on top of it,
yeah.
it's a jungle experience.
Do you
but
have?
It's beautiful because to me, I call that lush.
Yeah, lush.
Oh, it right. is lush. I mean, every nook and corner, you know, every street you go down, little courtyards, little interior courtyards, little alleyways, everything had something green and living, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah.
Like little ficus, all these plants that Alice and I can only grow as tropical house plants or only have in the summer in New York for 2 or 3 months
right.
do mm-hmm. beautifully there.
Well, that's their right, it's
yeah.
their native habitat.
Yeah.
Do you all have kudzu problems?
Oh, yes. And that's basically, you know, a cousin of cat's claw, basically. It has the same aggressive growth.
Right.
And speaking of courtyards and the tropical, that's where a lot of people are able to grow a lot of the tropical plant material. We don't plant a lot of tropical on our public spaces because we do some.
Uh-huh.
But in the 80s, there was a terrible freeze in the city where we lost a lot of the queen palms.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
some of the various types of ginger.
Uh-huh.
So we've been a little more conscious. But in Jackson Square, which is a space that we have, you know, staff 7 days a week that can kind of keep close eye on that, we do have quite a few tropicals, banana. We have the Mediterranean palm trees that are absolutely gorgeous.
Right.
So, you know, I love the fact that when you visited the city, you noticed the amount of plant material and how green we are.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was a while ago. It was pre-Katrina, but it was a memorable trip because I just felt like everything, you know, New York is so urban. And I mean, there's green space in New York. Naturally, we have Central Park.
Right.
We have lots of
Central Park, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Right.
But what's missing in New York is like,
you know, the residential little vignettes.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that, but we don't have the long season, the warmth and the humidity to be able to do the kinds of things. So I really felt transported when I was in New Orleans.
It just makes you
want
to take your clothes off.
Oh, I know.
Right. Yes,
and so drink.
You just have to wear very little without getting arrested.
Yeah.
But
that's no problem.
Come back because I think we are back. We are, you know, it's been a long time, and it will take a long time for certain areas of the city to really be back. And some areas won't ever be what they were pre-Katrina.
Right.
But I do believe our urban landscape has recovered and continues to recover, and we work hard every day to make sure that we continue putting interesting plant material along our major corridors, especially in our, you know, downtown area and in our pocket parks.
Yeah. So tell us, Anne, we're always very interested in how people got the job that they have. How did you, I mean, you have a huge title. How did you study horticulture? How did you get into it?
No, I am a manager, but I do have three landscape architects that work for the department. We do have arborists. I started with the city in 1994. I worked, and I started as a little, entry-level municipal government employee.
Uh-huh.
And I worked at the recreation department. New Orleans is very different from other cities as far as, because we have so much green space that is more planted. You know, a lot of cities, their recreation and parks department are combined.
Mm-hmm.
But because we have such unique green space that is not programmed,
you know,
there are ball fields. And then we have, you know, other cities don't have neutral grounds. We have almost 1,000 acres of neutral grounds, and there are no sports going on there. So I worked at NORD for 7 years, and I worked my way up to the deputy director, and then there was an opportunity for me to come. I have a business degree.
Okay.
But I had an opportunity to come to Parkways, and I jumped at it because I grew up in a home. My father had a beautiful rose garden. My grandparents, a lot of people in New Orleans, in the neighborhood that I grew up in, families, every Saturday, they were out there cutting their grass, working in their garden, dealing with their azaleas and camellias.
Yeah.
So that's how I grew up. I mean, we had azalea bushes. We had azaleas that bloomed in the spring, camellias that bloomed in the winter.
Right.
You know, petunias. You all plant petunias in the summer. We plant a lot of petunias in the winter and snapdragons.
Right.
So it's kind of opposite.
Right.
So it was always my interest, and when the opportunity came, I jumped at it because I thought I'm going to get paid to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, that works for me.
Yeah.
And I think I get to ride around the city every day and see something that our department touches. There's nothing, you can't ride around New Orleans and not see the impact of parks and parkways. And we have such an amazing team of people that a passionate municipal government employees that care about how, you know, we're not perfect like any other entity.
Right.
But that's how I got here. And, you know, I really believe, and I tell this to young people all the time, if you find something you're passionate about, you're going to be good at it because you're going to care.
That's
While
right.
I'm not a landscape architect or an arborist, there are plenty of them here. But I drive a lot of what we do and how we do it. And we risk, you know, we planted a bunch of metro palms, and those are not cheap,
right,
on Poydras. And we're very concerned because there is a palm wilt disease going around the country, but they have not impacted those. So we take risks because we don't want a monoculture.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
But we also recognize and we budget appropriately. You know, no city agency has enough money to do what they need to
do. Oh, never.
Right.
Never.
But I think we are really good stewards of the public money to create a canopy and a landscape that our citizens can be proud of. And also have the maintenance. And that's the challenge.
Right.
Planting and maintaining. And, you know, I tell the landscape architects all the time, so this is going to be difficult. We got to be interesting and creative, but we got to be able to maintain it.
Yeah.
So yes.
To tell an artist you can only use, skin colors when they're 30.
Right.
It's sometimes challenging, but we all recognize what we have to do. So that's kind of how I got my job.
And I'm excited to, and I'm just really thrilled that there's a lady in charge of
Parks.
Yes.
Well, the first female director of any city agency. Now, this was in the 70s, was Mildred Foshé, and she was the director of Parkways.
Right on.
Right on.
I do have a question, Anne. You mentioned the word neutral grounds.
Right.
What does that mean in terms?
It is a medium. It's basically a traffic divider. So if you go down major streets in New Orleans, they're cars going one way and then the other way. There is a neutral ground in the middle, a pallet of grass. We have some neutral grounds that may be 20 feet wide, 15 feet wide,
right,
or even as little as 4 feet wide. But they're basically a median, a traffic divider.
Okay.
But they are turfed in trees. Elysian Fields, which is a major corridor that goes from the river, the French Quarter, to mm-hmm. the lake. It's 60 acres, and it's lined with beautiful live oaks and cypress trees.
Wow. So how much property do you manage, Anne?
2,000 acres.
2,000 acres. Wow.
Over 300 parks.
Wow.
A golf course. Uh-huh. And the neutral grounds, and then some of the city buildings.
Wow.
But I would think the neutral grounds are our most challenging because just the location, some of them we want to plant, some of them are not wide enough to plant certain things, so we have to make sure that, that's where we use a holly.
Yeah.
Or that's where we'll use a palm because of the root system, can handle a more restricted space.
Right. Right. Well, that's what Carmen and I deal with. I mean, day in and day out, we're surrounded by so much cement.
Right.
We're doing, actually, Carmen and I are doing like a little public plaza beer garden restaurant. And we were digging just the other day. We're putting trees in and some shrubs. And just the other day, this has been fallow ground for probably 50 years, 40 years, and it's just gone through a little construction, because they renovated the back warehouse, and just trying to dig to put a stake in to mark where the tree was going to go mm-hmm. was just, it's just all hard pan, and it's so important to keep these areas aerated and with green nitrogen fixing plants, so that more can grow later and that the soil is stable so that these runoff issues don't, are mitigated.
Yeah.
In some cases, you have to start over. We had a challenge on one of our corridors where they did a major street project and a drainage project.
Mm-hmm.
So once they were done, a lot of the construction debris, concrete and various minerals were in the soil.
Right.
And so we planted willow oaks because of the upright growth of the canopy because they were so close to the roadway. And they really struggled. And we had the soil test and we realized it's all that construction stuff. So we had to do all, probably 3 years of mitigation to the soil around and treat the soil and fertilize and put nutrients back in.
Right.
And that's something we challenge. And, in any urban environment, you're going to have those issues.
Right.
And so I understand exactly where you're coming from because you want to put something in the ground. But if it doesn't have good, healthy soil to work with, then they won't survive. And that's a problem we have. A lot of times citizens want to plant on a public space. They want to, but the thing is, it's not putting it in the ground.
Right.
It's taking care of it, 6 months later, making sure it's watered, making sure it's got the right nutrients.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I understand exactly what you all are dealing with.
Yeah. I think we have a lot of similar situations, that we could talk about for hours.
Yeah. We're
whenever I meet someone, a fellow tree hugger, I just, go on and on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, our coastal cities have to stick together, right?
Yes, we do.
And help each other out.
Well, thank you, Anne, for joining us. I'm sorry we are reaching the end of our segment with you, but it was delightful to hear your sweet Southern accent and talk plants with you.
Well, thank you so very much. And anytime, I would love, and if you all ever come to New Orleans, please reach out to me. I would love to take you all around and show you some of our spaces that we're very proud of, and then some of the ones that we have some challenges with.
Well, I think Carmen and I could arrange that.
There's always a little bad with the good, but
yeah.
I'd love for you all to be able to see some of our pocket parks and around the city.
And likewise,
the city is much larger than just the French Quarter.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
And likewise, Anne, if you decide to come up to New York, get in touch,
and we'll
give you a little private tour of some gardens here.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Thank you, Anne. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few minutes, and we're going to go to Palm Springs, California.
Oh, if only it were true.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hello, welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are in Zone 9 today. We were just on the phone with Anne McDonald from New Orleans talking about the humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to go to Palm Springs and talk about the heat. Yes, Palm Springs is also in Zone 9.
That's right.
So we have a really awesome designer, plants person, on the line with us. His name is Troy Bancord from Palm Springs. So we're in the desert now. We've left the humidity for the heat. And I want to thank the Desert Horticultural Society of Coachella Valley because they connected us with Troy, who writes for the their magazine. So welcome, Troy Bancord.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. So a little bit about Troy. For 30 years, Troy Bancord has been designing and creating places of peace. He is well recognized for his excellence in connective landscape and interior design, consultation, and project installations. His unparalleled talents and skillfulness have resulted in the development of some of the most unique and imaginative properties in the desert Southwest, including the Phoenix and Tucson metro areas, as well as Los Angeles, Palm Springs, and Long Beach, California, Las Vegas, San Francisco, and even a little bit in Cape Cod and the Midwest. Troy comes from a family of contractors and interior designers, and it became a simple and natural progression for him to assist clients with their homes, creating dramatic and organically continuous indoor and outdoor living spaces. His projects are very tactile, intriguing all five of the senses, whether rusty steel and recycled concrete or slick chrome and glass. The materials Troy utilizes in his project installations always exude a remarkable sense of sophistication. His spaces are warm and inviting, clean and organic, and yet they are refined, and they range from intimate to golf courses and mountainside homes, to townhomes and garden flats, from formal to European-style estates and grand Mexican and Spanish-style haciendas to stylized, angular, mid-century modern homes. In 2006, Torrey was given the prestigious honor of being named Master of the Southwest. What a great title, by Phoenix Home and Garden magazine. And for, as Alice said, for 2 years now, he has written the garden maintenance article for the Desert Horticultural Society of Coachella Valley's monthly newsletter. He's also been on TV, radio, and has numerous writing gigs. So we really have a tastemaker on our show today.
Wow. That was a long intro. Thank you.
It was. So, Troy, tell us about, we just left the director of parks for New Orleans. Tell us about the typical weather in Palm Springs.
Well, today it's atypical. It is 69 and overcast.
Oh. Wow.
Normally, 99 days out of 100, it's bright, sunny, aqua skies and crystal clear. It's just beautiful. We're having a little bit of a freak rainstorm that's coming through right now from the southeast. And so, but normally it's quite dry here. So we welcome any precipitation we can get.
Sure. Yeah, right. So what elevation is Palm Springs?
Palm Springs is about 500 foot above sea level.
Okay. So you're not grossly off from New Orleans, but it is a difference.
Yes. And of course we do have the mountains surrounding us, so as you get up onto the mountains,
right,
where some of the homes are, it's definitely a little cooler and whatnot up there.
Right.
So.
Tell us about watering practices where you are. I know that's a real issue in Palm Springs and in California.
Right. Well, luckily, we had a lot of precipitation this winter, and so they have lifted our water restrictions, which doesn't mean that we can just let the water run down the street any longer. But as of last year, we were required to turn our sprinkler systems down to 3 days a week and only watering in the nighttime hours between 7 at night and 7 in the morning, and which became really problematic for us because our soils are all sand. It used to be we used to be totally underwater here. So everything dries out within a matter of a half a day or a day. And so to be restricted to 3 times a week really set us back a little bit.
Sure. So what were your horticultural choices to deal with the restrictions?
Well, there was a kind of a knee-jerk reaction with a lot of people freaking out of homeowners associations and communities and to pull out all the lawn and put in quote-unquote desert landscaping. And so that's kind of, I think now that people are in that mindset of less water, even though they've lifted the restrictions, communities are still restricting water, still moving forward with some of the lawn removals and bringing in more desert-oriented plant material. Because it used to be a veritable oasis here. It was a lot of grass, a lot of golf courses, flowers all over mixed with the palms and the cacti. And so, not quite the oasis it used to be, but it's still lush and beautiful and glorious with palms. And
right.
So what makes it an oasis, Troy, for people who haven't been there? Where is the water coming from that makes this an oasis?
Well, we are surrounded by mountains, the San Jacintos.
Okay.
And the highest elevations near us are anywhere from 7,500 to 9,500 feet.
Yeah.
So in the winter, we can look up. It'll be 75 or 80 degrees on the Palm Springs desert floor, and we can look up and see snow on our mountains all around us. So that snow will then melt and fill our aquifer, and we're also sitting on a huge natural lake and a lot of hot springs in the area. So there's a huge underground water supply here anyway.
Okay.
So we're fortunate to have that. That's where a lot of the water came from years ago, in addition to the runoff from the mountains.
Okay. Just so people can understand, you know, geographically and geologically, like, how this became an oasis.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, we were just on the phone with New Orleans, and she was describing New Orleans as in a bowl. And you said the same thing. So I find that pretty interesting that, you know, you're both kind of, you're not that far off of sea level, but then you're surrounded by these mountains, and that's where all of your water comes from, down into the base of this bowl, which is kind of interesting.
Correct.
Tell us, I want our viewers, if you can get online as you're listening to this, and go to your website, Troy Bancord, B-A-N-K-O-R-D, design.com. You have the most gorgeous plant groupings. And also, I talk about zone envy. I mean, we're in New York, and to be able to plant the things that you can plant, it's what I struggle with on a daily basis as I'm sitting, you know, at my drafting table figuring out plant lists. Tell us about your groupings.
You know, I'm a real freak for the juxtaposition of cacti and geraniums and roses and agave.
Yeah.
And succulents and annuals in the same pot. So luckily, our sandy soils allow us to, I guess there can be a tendency to overwater in areas where the soils are clay or heavier.
Mm-hmm.
But because our soils are so sandy, the roots just really go nuts. Everything drains so well. So we really have a lot of plants, salvias and different things that do well in our soils because they drain. But, you know, I'm kind of maybe an English garden lover at heart. I love the look of a crisp, clean hedge. We do a lot of hedging with olives.
Mm-hmm.
I love that gray-green backdrop with green roses in the foreground or massing of agave with a crisp hedge. So I love that really odd juxtaposition of things that people wouldn't normally expect to see, but somehow they work.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, California in general, you can just pretty much plant something in the ground and it grows. Palm Springs, of course, being in the desert, is a little different.
Right.
You really have to know and understand the importance of watering systems. And as we say, you know, watering is 90% of landscaping here in the desert. The other 10% is knowing what plants to put where and knowing how to maintain them. But it's the water here is so huge with our intense sun and heat.
What I loved are the grass combinations with the agaves and the kangaroo paw. Like that to me.
Kangaroo paw, we love that.
I know.
We have it available to us here, and of course, it's an annual.
People think it looks weird, but
yeah,
I love it.
I know. Whenever, only very, very few clients, you know, it's hard to pull off sometimes because, you know, it's just not the same backdrop.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So you would, it's hard.
Yeah. And sometimes in those climates where you are, it's seasonal, and so you have to use those things as annuals and mix them in together and pots and beds.
Right.
It gets a little pricey, but the excitement is still there for you seasonally.
Yeah.
We have one client who's from California originally, and we made a garden for her a couple of years ago, and she can't get the California garden out of her head, you know? And
she's from Pasadena.
It's tough. We are so lucky here. I mean, I can create an Asian garden. I can create, you know, native gardens. I can do Italian. We are just so lucky. And just invariably create a Garden of Eden here. You know, but again, you've got to know what you're doing with water. So
right.
That's our important aspect.
How has your taste evolved, Troy? You've been doing this for a while. How do you feel like your personal taste and aesthetic has evolved over the years?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Growing up in the Midwest on 5 acres in this old Georgian brick farmhouse and learning plant material, I started grooming and pruning and deadheading flowers at the age of 6 or 7.
Wow.
And then moving out to Phoenix originally, I couldn't handle all the gloom and doom as a gardener.
Right.
I was a forerunner in native plant maintenance, as far as pruning things to look natural. A lot of things would be trimmed into balls and squares.
Meatballs.
And the movement was toward a more of a natural look. And so how do you prune things that they don't look pruned. So then I bought my first mid-century modern home in 1997, walls of glass at the base of the mountain, and it totally just changed. All of a sudden, I was dumped with all these modern projects. It's almost like the universe said, here's your house. Now you're going to change and go 160 or 180 degrees the other direction. We're going to give you all these modernist clients, and mm-hmm. boom. Mm-hmm. So, and then my infatuation with Palm Springs evolved, and all the mid-century architecture here, and the glass, and the connected indoor-outdoor.
Mm-hmm.
And so my styles range from, you know, Cape Cod to Tudors to I worked on a Frank Lloyd Wright project. Now I'm really passionate about, you know, modern, you know, homes with glass. But I just welcome any design genre. So I've run the gamut, and it's been really exciting.
Yeah. Actually, Carmen and I kind of have a similar philosophy in that we do not have a style that we impose on people. Rather, we let the home and the client and how the space is going to be used dictate. And then we, you know.
Absolutely.
You gently suggest.
Yes.
Plant choices that are, you know, indicative of their vision, but at the same time are going to pay their rent, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I know it sounds kind of funny, but if you just stand quietly at a property, it tells you what it wants to be. I'm very intuitive, and the minute I pull up, I just take in a project, I can see where the walkway should be, where there needs to be some depth and dimension, where the property's out of balance. So a lot of times, like you say, the property just it dictates what it wants to be. You just have to know how to be open to receiving it and then putting it on paper and then implementing that design. So,
okay, Troy, here's a question. Plants that you can't stand. Tell us some plants that you hate. Because every gardener has some.
You know, there's probably the plant that I abhor the most is hibiscus. And I know I'm probably going to get a lot of people gasping when I say that. It, you know, it's beautiful in Hawaii. It's beautiful in Florida. It just seems so tropical here, and I just get tired of battling white flies and aphids and iron chlorosis and root rot. And I mean, it's just people in the desert, just give up on hibiscus, will you?
Yeah.
There's a desert hibiscus that's really great, that's oriented to the dead with a smaller flower. But I just, really don't care for hibiscus.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good one.
I'm with you, too. And, the flower only lasts a day.
Right.
It makes a slippery, disgusting mess,
It's gaudy.
It's just gaudy. It's really, you're right. It belongs in Florida. It works in Hawaii, maybe in a few other southern states. But when clients ask us for it here, you know, I'm just like, you just try to talk him into something else. It just
doesn't
it doesn't play nicely with other plants.
Right.
It's so dominant.
Right.
You know, it's so dominant. It just,
and their colors are hard to work in
sometimes
to other things. Their colors are very intense. So it's hard to match and create, you know, a
vignette with it.
Yeah.
It's like in your face. It's like Rita.
It's gratuitous.
Yeah. It's like Rita Moreno, you know, like it's just.
Well, I'm not a real fan of bright red. And I think of hibiscus mainly being red.
Yeah.
And so red is just a really hot, harsh color here. And I like softer, cooler colors that blend with the gray green agave and the cacti. So red is just a tough one. Just stands out like a sore thumb, like red geraniums.
Right.
Love geraniums on the right property, but I'm more into probably corals and softer colors.
It's like your aunt from New Jersey who just will not leave New Jersey, right?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's where being knowledgeable on plants, you know, clients will come to us and say, I really want this plant. And so that's where you have to dig deep and say, well, how about this as an alternative or that as an alternative?
Right.
So oftentimes I can talk to you like you probably can talk your clients into a different substitute that's a better fit.
I love that you get to use olive as a hedge.
I know. I'm so – that's causing severe zone envy for
right.
me.
Yeah.
Oh, I tell you. And when they're trimmed as a hedge, they're a deeper gray-green, and they are just beautiful. And what I love about them, they don't freeze if we have a freeze. They're really tolerant to our hot temperatures and our intense sun and our crummy soils.
Right.
And they're a beautiful transitional plant when you want a hedge. Mm-hmm. In, say, a desert setting, we don't want bright green that looks so domesticated.
Yeah.
The olive kind of takes you somewhere else, Mediterranean, the gray-green. It really blends with our gray-green desert plants. It's really a great transitional plant.
Yeah.
A lot of different. And then it creates that contrast with deep greens as well as the gray-green of their leaves. So
yeah.
I just can't use olive enough.
We used to be able to use olives, the Russian olive here in New York, but now it's on the invasive list, and you can't even find it.
Yeah, it's not available.
You have to sneak and dig it up on the highway
if
in
you
the
want
middle
some.
Of the night if you want some.
Yeah, we've been forbidden to plant
Bring
that.
In the root.
That's right.
And the vitamin B1 and great, you know, do what, 20 Hail Marys and hope that it grows.
And no, officer, I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm just digging up this invasive plant because I need it for a rooftop project.
Trying to save it.
That's right.
Trying to save it.
This is an endangered plant. We have to get it into.
That's right.
Well, I want to leave a little bit of...
Doing our best for Mother Earth.
That's right. Well, Troy, I want to leave a little bit of time. We only have a few minutes, but I want to talk about the mission of the Desert Horticultural Society of the Coachella Valley, because Alice and I like to give opportunity for nonprofits to talk about their mission and what they're doing for their particular region. So tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, the mission of the Desert Horticultural Society is to open people's eyes. You know, much of our population here is buying their second home, and they're coming from Seattle or New York or Minneapolis or Chicago. And so they're inclined to want to make, and of course, all the green grass we have for years creates that oasis feel. And so people try to create replicate their Midwestern gardens here, so to speak, turning into balls and squares and whatnot. And so what we're trying to do is raise awareness that there are a lot of beautiful desert natives that do really well in our soils that are better acclimated for this climate and our heat. And so we're just trying to create awareness with, you know, garden tours and monthly newsletters and meetings and road trips to different horticultural societies, botanical gardens, bringing in new plant introductions out of Phoenix from our Sonoran Desert that are being searched and found and propagated in the Phoenix area by Ron Gass of Mountain States Nurseries. So it's just an awareness to bring more of a water-wise conscientiousness to the desert here.
Right. I think that's amazing because even though this year you did happen to get a lot of rain, I don't think that this is the end of droughts in the South, in California and in the Southwest by any means. You know, I think it's probably going to be, it's going to continue.
Sure.
You know, so why not work with what works, you know?
Well, and on top of that, there seems to be still more and more development sucking off this water supply.
Yeah.
And if there's a drought and we continue to develop it, it creates monumental issues for water. And we need to make sure that we have water for the future for our plants and for our sustainability. So,
right. Infrastructure.
Very important.
Right. Infrastructure.
Yeah.
Well, Troy, please give our listeners your website again and also the Hort website. And we encourage people to start learning about these issues and about these plants in different zones.
Thank you. Yeah, it's Troy Bancor Design, and it's Troy, BANKORD, design.com. And then the website for the Desert Horticultural Society is DesertHorticulturalSociety.org.
Great. Well, thank you. And it was so lovely to have met you virtually and now on the radio. So thanks for joining us and sharing your environment and your experience.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for the opportunity, and you keep on plugging on with all the good things that you're doing.
We will do. Thanks.
Thank you. So listen, folks, if you have a story to share from your zone, we have a lot more zones to cover.
That's right.
8 more zones this year. Get in touch and we will consider it for an episode or for our blog. The show was written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Remember to subscribe to our blog, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at WeDigPlants to stay current on our projects and our upcoming shows. Of course, we're on Instagram at WeDigPlants/GroundworksGardensNYC. Thanks for listening.
See you in the virtual garden.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.